content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Week magazine. Today, we're reading from the September 22nd, 2023 issue of the Week. Our cover drawing this week is the New York City skyline in the background. Looks like sunset, beautiful colors. In the foreground is the Statue of Liberty. But she has put down her torch. It's sitting at her feet, and her right hand is held out in front of her in a stop motion. Stern look on her face, and in her left hand is a tablet that reads simply, "No Vacancy." The headline is, "Sanctuary City Blues, Why a Surge in Asylum Seekers Has Democrats Rethinking Immigration." That is one of our main stories, and we'll start right there. New York City overwhelmed by migrant surge. What happened? A massive influx of asylum seekers to New York City is threatening to destroy the city in a financial tsunami, Mayor Eric Adams said this week. The mayor, a Democrat, said the cost of housing, feeding, and processing the 110,000 migrants who have arrived since last year would sap at least $12 billion from city coffers by 2025. That will force him to make deep budget cuts across the board of 5 to 15%. These tough decisions are a direct result of inaction in Washington and in Albany, Adams said. Longtime New Yorkers and asylum seekers will feel these potential cuts, and they will hurt. He said that concerns he raised with President Biden last year over immigration policies remain unaddressed, and added, "Any plan that does not include stopping the flow at the border is a failed plan." Other Democratic-run cities and states are also struggling to absorb migrants. In Chicago, where some 2,000 migrants are sleeping on the floors of police stations and airports, Mayor Brandon Johnson said he could take in no more without significant support and immigration policy changes. In New Jersey, Governor Phil Murphy opposed Biden's recent request to use Atlantic City International Airport as a shelter, saying he doesn't see any scenario under which his state could help alleviate New York's overflow. Massachusetts, which declared a state emergency last month over the rapid increase of arrivals, this week deployed National Guard troops to assist at shelters. Massachusetts Governor Maura Healey urged the president to fast-track work authorizations to enable migrants to afford their own accommodations. The Biden administration needs to act, she said. They need to act now. What the editorial said. Even Democrats are starting to squeal as the fallout of Biden's border malpractice hits home, said the Washington Examiner. Adams has tried to blame Texas Governor Greg Abbott for busing migrants to his city, calling him a madman. Nice try. In fact, Abbott has shipped fewer than 35,000 migrants out of state since 2022, while more than 6 million border crossings have occurred under Biden's watch. This summer, crossings shot back up, with early data indicating 177,000 border apprehensions in August alone. Immigration will not destroy New York City, said the New York Daily News. Adams says we're getting 10,000 migrants a month, but 120 years ago, as many as 10,000 immigrants were arriving by ship daily. True, there was no right to shelter mandate back then, as there is now, and the costs of housing so many are steep, at more than $380 per person per night. But the city's population decreased during the pandemic, and we're suffering from a labor crunch. rather than treating immigrants as a burden. Let's welcome them and put them to work. What the columnist said. What a difference a few years makes, said Jim Garrity in National Review. Before 2021, Democrats called their opponents xenophobes and boasted of their jurisdiction status as sanctuary cities or sanctuary states that protected undocumented immigrants from deportation. But mass migration is no longer primarily somebody else's problem. Now, when blue state mayors and governors speak, you could be forgiven for thinking you're at a Trump rally. Not quite, said Greg Sargent in the Washington Post. Many Republicans want asylum seekers kept out of the country entirely, but Adams and the other Democrats just want them to be allowed to work. They've asked Biden to award temporary protected status to the newcomers to help get them off the city dole. Even though Biden gave such status to thousands of Venezuelans in 2021, he has been reluctant to do so now, perhaps fearing a Republican backlash. But GOP lawmakers have demonstrated zero interest in making the processing of migrants easier or more rational. It would be hard to devise a more backward and self-defeating system than our current one, said former New York City Mayor Michael Bloomberg in the New York Times. It allows millions of people to enter and claim asylum, then condemns them to state-enforced poverty and vagrancy as they wait 6 or 7 years for courts to process their claims. Congressional deadlock over immigration is primarily to blame, but Biden has executive authority to offer work permits, and he should use it. Failing to act will risk political damage to Democrats up and down the ticket in 2024. Controversy of the week. Biden, should Democrats panic over his poll numbers? Don't compare me to the Almighty, President Biden likes to quip. Compare me to the alternative. But what if voters prefer the alternative, asks Harry Enten in CNN.com. 14 months before Election Day, a raft of worrisome new data spells major trouble for Biden's reelection. A Wall Street Journal poll last week had the president tied at 46% with Donald Trump, the presumptive Republican nominee, despite his 91 felony charges. More alarming for Democrats, only 53% of non-white voters support Biden, according to a New York Times poll, down from 70% who voted for him in 2020. Then there are the concerns over Biden's age, with 73% of voters, including 49% of Democrats, saying Biden, 80, is too old to be president. Only 47% say the same about the 77-year-old Trump. It's perfectly rational if these numbers make you want to scream in fear and anger, said Paul Waldman in MSNBC.com. Inflation has plummeted, and Biden has the best one-term job creation record of any president in history. Yet most voters say he's done a poor job on the economy, and nearly half prefer Trump, who is openly promising to dismantle democracy as soon as he gets a chance. It's almost a Democratic tradition to panic at this point in the cycle, said Heather Digby Parton in Salon. Back in 2011, pundits and party members were muttering that it might be wise to run a primary challenge against President Barack Obama after his approval numbers fell to the 30s in some polls. 14 months later, Obama beat Mitt Romney in a romp. By next November, voters should be feeling the effects of the booming economy, while Biden's opponent could be running as a convicted felon. Voters typically have a fixed opinion of Trump, said Benji Sarlin in Semaphore. Opinions of Biden are a lot more malleable, and Democrats have more than a year and a $1 billion war chest to spend helping voters appreciate his achievements. That 46%, in other words, is likely a ceiling for Trump's support, but a floor for Biden's. But in 14 months, Biden will also be that much older, said Andrew Sullivan in his Substack newsletter. Yes, Trump is only 3 years younger, as outraged Democrats keep pointing out, but Trump still throbs with a maniacal energy and stamina and obsessiveness, while Biden looks increasingly feeble, confused, and, well, in his 80s. Biden's age would matter less with a popular running mate, said David Ignatius in the Washington Post. But Vice President Kamala Harris has failed to gain traction in the country or even within her own party, as he can't drop her from the ticket for fear of alienating black women. Biden should withdraw from the race himself and do it soon. Time is running out for Democrats to choose and rally behind a new standard bearer. What if nobody wants the job, said Jonathan Chait in New York Magazine. The logic of replacing Biden with a younger candidate in 2024 is obvious. Discounting kooks like Marianne Williamson and RFK Jr., though, no Democrat has yet stepped forward to be that replacement. Party leaders fret that a primary fight could weaken Biden for the general election. They're right, said Jonathan V. Last in the Bulwark. And so are those Democrats terrified of entrusting the fate of U.S. democracy to an unpopular octogenarian. That's the unhappy reality for Democrats. Biden is both a risky bet and the best available bet. The results of the 2024 election will be uncertain right up until the votes are counted. It was a good week for spies and terrorists after The Intercept published an internal directive from National Security Agency head Paul Nakasone informing staff that covert surveillance targets must henceforth be treated with dignity and respect, regardless of their nationality. It was a good week for ink-stained Swifties after USA Today posted a job opening for a Taylor Swift reporter with a salary of up to $100,000. The outlet said the new hire will help quench the public's undeniable thirst for all things Taylor Swift. It's a good week for prophecies after a parody account on X posted on Monday afternoon that New York Jets quarterback Aaron Rodgers is going to tear his Achilles on a rain-drenched MetLife turf in 2.5 hours. Almost exactly to the minute, Rodgers suffered the season-ending injury predicted by user at Daddy Zaslav. But it was a bad week for retail politics after Susanna Gibson, a Democrat running for Virginia's House, was reported to have performed sex acts with her husband for money on the streaming platform Chatterbait. Gibson, 40, called the revelations an illegal invasion of my privacy. It's a bad week for the oral tradition after Republican Senator Tommy Tuberville explained that his one-man blockade of U.S. military promotions was necessary because the U.S. Navy is now so woke that we got people doing poems on aircraft carriers over a loudspeaker. Finally, it was a bad week for Human Endeavor after Florida man Ray Bellucci was arrested 70 miles off the coast of Georgia while attempting to run across the Atlantic on a giant hamster wheel. Bellucci was apprehended for threatening Coast Guard officers with a bomb, a charge he denies. On the briefing page, toxic forever chemicals. PFAS, P-F-A-S, compounds are used in thousands of products and have been linked to numerous health risks. Should we be worried? What are forever chemicals? As their nickname suggests, per- and polyfluoroalkyl substances, PFAS, are a class of hardy man-made compounds that can take hundreds or even thousands of years to break down. Introduced in the 1950s by chemical giants DuPont and 3M, PFAS resist water, oil, or corrosion and heat, making them useful for myriad home and industrial needs. They're the reason bacon slides off a Teflon-coated frying pan, rain bounces off a Scotchgard-sprayed shoe, and burger boxes don't absorb grease. But forever chemicals aren't simply found in the products we use. These compounds have seeped into our soil and drinking water and are now present in the food we eat and the dust particles we inhale. We're really seeing PFAS absolutely everywhere, said Elsie M. Sunderland, an environmental chemist at Harvard University. Federal studies show that about 98% of Americans have PFAS in their blood. Some of those compounds can take years to leave the body. Scientists are now uncovering links between those ubiquitous chemicals and a host of health risks, including cancer, liver damage, hormone disruption, and birth defects, leading regulators and lawmakers to try to limit their use. Are these compounds widely used? Forever chemicals are almost inescapable in modern life. They're used in stain-resistant carpets and furniture, in nail polish, raincoats, sanitary pads and tampons, paint, mascara, camping gear, sunscreen, toilet paper, and post-it notes. PFAS-based firefighting foam, which is up to 10% forever chemicals by weight, has for decades been deployed at refineries, airports, and military bases to extinguish oil-based blazes. The groundwater around at least 385 military bases nationwide is now contaminated with forever chemicals, according to a report from the nonprofit Environmental Working Group. If you are relying on well water and are near one of these bases, said Scott Faber, a senior vice president at EWG, you should be concerned. And PFAS are present in water far beyond those locations. A recent U.S. Geological Survey found the chemicals in nearly half the nation's tap water. At every site where PFAS were detected, levels were above the health advisory range recommended by the Environmental Protection Agency. What are PFAS health effects? They appear to be vast, although conducting clinical trials to examine the long-term toxicity of PFAS exposure would be impractical and unethical. A 2012 study funded by DuPont as part of a legal settlement examined whether the local community near a West Virginia Teflon factory had been harmed by decades of dumping PFAS-laden waste into the Ohio River. It found a probable link between one compound and high cholesterol, ulcerative colitis, thyroid disease, testicular cancer, kidney cancer, and pregnancy-induced hypertension. Other studies have found that exposure to PFAS can weaken the immune systems of children, reducing the number of antibodies they generate after receiving a vaccination, and that children are at a higher risk of obesity in later life if their mothers were exposed to certain forever chemicals during pregnancy. Why might PFAS be harmful? Because there are more than 12,000 types of forever chemicals, scientists don't yet have a definitive answer. But studies suggest some PFAS molecules bind easily to a major blood protein, then circulate throughout the body to organs and other tissues. Cells let some PFAS molecules through their outer walls because the chemicals look like the fatty acids they burn for fuel. Once inside cell, PFAS have been shown to cause structural damage linked to cancer, diabetes, and cardiovascular disease. Forever chemicals seem to build up, especially in the liver. Experiments on rodents have shown that PFAS can boost the risk of non-alcoholic fatty liver disease. Notably, that condition has soared among Americans in recent decades. While it may be impossible to pin a single individual's illness on forever chemicals, I have not seen a PFAS tested for toxicity that's not toxic, said Scott Belcher, a PFAS expert at North Carolina State University. What's being done to tackle the health risks? Lawsuits and fear of litigation are pushing some manufacturers and major PFAS users to clean up and reduce their use of forever chemicals. In August, 3M reached a $10.3 billion settlement with a group of public water providers over claims its firefighting foams contaminated groundwater. The fund will be used to test and treat water supplies across the country. The company, which admits no wrongdoing, has pledged to end production of all PFAS by 2025. Restaurant chains such as McDonald's, Burger King, and Chick-fil-A have made commitments in recent years to phase out PFAS in their food packaging. The EPA has also proposed new rules to limit levels of the two most common PFAS in drinking water and wants those compounds designated as hazardous substances, a change that could force companies to spend up to $22 billion scrubbing the most heavily polluted U.S. sites. Global warming aside, this is probably the most expensive environmental problem we're ever going to face, said Graham Peasley, a nuclear chemist at the University of Notre Dame. We're going to have to get inventive on how to filter it out for all of our days. Moving into a few of the best columns. Start with criminalizing abortion travel. Red states have found yet another way to control pregnant girls and women, said Melissa Girard Grant. Two Texas counties have adopted ordinances against abortion trafficking, a new vague offense aimed at stopping women from traveling to seek abortions where they remain legal. A similar law went into effect this spring in Idaho, where it's now illegal to assist a minor in traveling outside of the state to get an abortion. Other red states are considering similar laws. Supporters of these laws cite the White Slave Traffic Act of 1910, known as the Mann Act, which was amended in 1986 to forbid transporting women for illegal sexual activity and doesn't mention abortion at all. Reviving old laws is all the rage for the post-Roe anti-abortion movement because state bans aren't stopping women who can afford to travel from going to other states to exercise their reproductive rights. So these authoritarian extremists are expanding the web of criminalization to anyone who supports someone seeking an abortion. It's now clear that anti-abortion activists weren't satisfied with ending Roe v. Wade and supposedly turning the issue over to the states. Instead, they're getting bolder and taking up yet more creative ways to restrict bodily autonomy. America's economy is still the best. The U.S. has its political and economic problems, said Gerald Baker, but countries in both Europe and Asia are far worse off. At a recent conference of European business and political leaders in Italy, the mood was one of psychic gloom. An Italian think tanker bemoaned his country's demographic winter, with its deaths now far outpacing births. Glum Germans said their country has become the sick man of Europe, With its once exceptional economy stagnating amid both painfully high inflation and a recession, critical German industries such as car making and capital equipment are in decline, and disastrous public policies have left the country dependent on Russian energy and exports to China. The British are even in worse shape, with strikes, high inflation, a punishing tax burden, and Brexit conspiring to create a bleak landscape. The malaise is not limited to Europe. China's economic contradictions and aging population are crippling its growth and future with calamitous social consequences that the Communist Party is desperately trying to conceal and suppress. America's economic model and dynamism still set us apart, and we should not follow Europe and China down the road to degrowth and decline. This column's from Mexico. The truth behind the murder of 43 students. 9 years after 43 students vanished in southern Mexico, the shocking extent of officials' complicity has finally been revealed, said Andres Martinez in InfoBay from Argentina. A New York Times investigation has found that not only narcos, but also police and even the military in Guerrero State colluded on the murder of these young men. On September 26, 2014, police in the town of Iguala intercepted several buses carrying about 100 students from Ayotzinapa Teachers College and forced 43 of them into patrol cars. The students were never seen again. Eventually, international investigators established that police had handed them over to the Guerreros Unidos cartel, which killed them and burned their bodies. But investigators complained that the military and local government were refusing to cooperate. And now we know why. Soldiers on the cartel's payroll gave the hitmen weapons, corrupt mayors quashed local investigations, and a coroner got rid of the students' bodies in his family's crematorium. In short, public officials were working for the gang. The Times story laid out this corrupt tale in compelling detail, said Gustavo de Hoyos Walter. It is based on 23,000 text messages obtained by the U.S. Drug Enforcement Agency via wiretap, which confirmed that Guerreros Unidos ordered local police to intercept the buses because they mistook the students for a rival gang. The messages also reveal that the Mexican military used the Israeli spy technology Pegasus to track down the suspected kidnappers early on, but never shared that information with police who were searching for the students. Had they done so, many lives would probably have been saved. Why did it take two American entities, the DEA and the New York Times, to unravel this Mexican mystery? Because in Mexico, we always pay more attention to research published abroad, said Sergio Sarmiento. In fact, Mexicans already knew the government was deeply involved in the Iguala case. The most novel thing about the report is the news that Omar Gomez Trejo, special prosecutor in the Ayotzinapa case, has fled to the United States because he is afraid for his safety. That's alarming, given that he was appointed by President Andrés Manuel López Obrador. The president came into office in 2018, promising to get justice for the Iguala victims, but instead he has downplayed the extent of the corruption. This expose is part of an American campaign to put pressure on López Obrador to get the cartels under control, said Leopoldo Mendivil. Republican candidates for U.S. president keep threatening to invade Mexico for national security reasons. I don't believe that will actually happen, but I do believe the Biden administration is sending our government the message that it must overhaul its strategy against the narcos. Why else would the DEA suddenly deliver such an enormous volume of compromising information to the Times? The United States has a way of making itself heard. Time for the last word, our feature article. Henry Ford's Lost City. The auto magnate wanted his company town to be a utopia in the Amazon, said Terrence McCoy in the Washington Post. What remains is a battered monument to misguided ambitions. Fordlandia, Brazil. When he was a young man, Luiz Magno Ribeiro felt nothing but pride in his city. It was, he believed, the most miraculous town in Brazil, a place of many firsts. The first settlement deep in the Amazon rainforest to have running water and electricity, the first to treat patients in a modern hospital, the first to build a swimming pool, a cinema, street lamps, an oasis of civilization in a remote jungle. Fordlandia, where Henry Ford tried to defeat the Amazon and was instead defeated. But one recent morning, as Magno set out to inspect the community, it wasn't all that the 49-year-old felt. It was frustration and grievance. Despite all of Magno's efforts, despite the community's backing, despite the help of federal attorneys and a recent order by a judge, the remarkable history of Ford's effort to harvest Amazon rubber was being lost, historic building by historic building, and the roughly 2,000 people still here, many of them impoverished descendants of Ford workers, were being forgotten again. Now came another sign of neglect. As Magno, the town historian, walked through the neighborhood where Ford's executives once enjoyed the comforts of a Midwest suburb, wide-screened balconies, concrete sidewalks, porcelain bathtubs, he smelled something acrid. There, inside one of the stately houses, he saw it. Bat guano, mounds of it. The elegant home had been taken over by a squatter, in a colony of bats. He didn't even clean it up, said Magno, furious at the squatter. There must be 20 pounds of guano in here, and no one does a thing. I've never seen this city in worse condition. Nearly a century ago, the Ford Motor Company spent heavily in blood and coin to construct what became, practically overnight, one of the Amazon's largest cities. Thousands of acres of forest were raised, millions of dollars were spent, hundreds of workers died. But neither Ford nor the Brazilian government, which assumed control of the property when the company departed in 1945, has done much of anything to preserve this historic town whose brief heyday came at so high a cost. In recent years, Fordlandia's collapse has only accelerated. The hospital, designed by Ford architect Albert Kahn and the first to perform complicated surgeries deep in the Amazon, was ransacked a decade ago and stripped of its roofing and walls. The cinema, where American poetry was read in Portuguese, was condemned as a safety hazard in 2020 and knocked down. And this year, the last resident who had worked for Ford died at 102. There won't be a Fordlandia in 30 more years, Magno lamented. It will all be lost. Henry Ford had a problem. He had revolutionized factory assembly work and made the automobile affordable for the masses, but he didn't have direct control of a rubber supply that would guarantee the company's continued success. Most rubber was produced by European colonial plantations in Southeast Asia. By the 1920s, there was talk of a rubber cartel. Ford feared that such a group could dictate rubber prices worldwide, giving it the power to cripple his company. So the pioneering industrialist, an early believer in vertical integration, looked for a way to outflank them and produce his own rubber. He settled on the region where it was first harvested, the Amazon. He found willing partners in Brazil, which was keen to revitalize the rainforest moribund rubber industry. Brazil, in an early example of the extraordinary incentives it would offer multinational corporations to set up in the Amazon, granted Ford in 1927 a parcel nearly the size of Connecticut. The prospect was attractive to Ford for several reasons. Increasingly disillusioned by an American turning toward urbanism, he saw the Amazon an opportunity to start over. He wanted to build not just factories and plantations, but a pastoral utopia, transporting a bucolic Midwestern town imprinted with its own idiosyncratic taste and interest to the heart of the Amazon. He discouraged drinking, gambling, Catholicism, yucca flower, and cows, the crudest machine in the world, Ford called the animal. At the maternity ward, infants would be given soy milk. By some measures, Ford succeeded. By the 1930s, a new town had risen out of the forest. On one side extended fire hydrant-lined streets, Riverside Avenue, Hillside, Main Street. At the center were massive Detroit-style warehouses. And on the other side was the American Village. Built for American executives, the neighborhood had it all. A clubhouse, hotel, tennis court, swimming pool, golf course, swing sets, a movie theater, and five stately homes furnished with wooden American furniture and paintings of rural Midwestern landscapes. Ed Townsend, 81, grew up inside one. "I remember it being a very pleasant environment," recalled Townsend, now a banker in Oklahoma. "An enjoyable, pleasant, beautiful, clean city." But there was a dark side. Hundreds died in the town's construction. According to Florida State University researcher Marcos Colon, most of them from disease. And in its fundamental purpose, to harvest rubber, the experiment was a disaster. Ford's buffoonish executives did virtually everything wrong, planting in the wrong season, in the wrong terrain, with the wrong seeds. Clustering Hevia brasiliensis, a rubber tree that grows best when naturally dispersed. Plagues struck, pests invaded. When Ford workers introduced ants to kill them, the ants became yet another pest. In 1945, after nearly two decades and $20 million spent, Ford wanted out. The company sold its properties and everything on them, the hospitals, houses, factories, manufacturing equipment, to the Brazilian government for a pittance, then departed. The Brazilians, as if to punctuate that Ford's strange experiment was over, turned Fordlandia into a cattle ranch. More than 70 years later, in the spring of 2016, a young judge named Domingos Motinho accompanied his wife on a work trip to the nearby gold mining town of Itatuba. One day, when his wife was busy at work, he decided to visit a place whose history had always fascinated him. Fordlandia was just up the river. Riding up the Tapajos, Motinho watched as verdant forests blurred past, each bend indistinguishable from the last. Then the unusual spectacle came into view. Sprawling rusted warehouses, a 150-foot water tower, once the Amazon's tallest structure, a water treatment facility. Stepping ashore, Motinho asked if anyone could give him a tour. That was when he met Magno. The historian was just finishing up a day job as a school teacher. The pair spent hours touring the town. Motinho was stunned. One of the warehouses looked suspended in time, as if the workers had dropped their tools mid-shift and never returned. It was filled with dust-lacquered machinery, lugged from cities as distant as Cincinnati, and stamped with the manufacturer's insignia, Southwark Foundry and Machine Company, Brown and Sharp, Westinghouse. Magno told Martino that Fordlandia had been left to rot. Despite pledges to preserve the town, no Brazilian authority had done much. Not the federal government, and not the city of Aveiro, which included Fordlandia within its borders. In what promised to be an automotive capital, not a single road is paved. Electricity can go out for days at a time. None of the water is treated. 4 in 5 people in the broader city of Aveiro live in poverty, and 1 in 4 adults are illiterate. We were born rich, Magno liked to say, then became poor. In 1990, state officials, responding to the lamentations of townspeople, submitted a request for historical recognition. The designation, granted by the National Historical and Artistic Heritage Institute, protects historic properties and incentivizes restoration with tax write-offs. Fordlandia's leaders considered the recognition a crucial step toward resurrecting the town and drawing tourists. But the request, which typically takes about 5 years to process, had languished without explanation for more than 25. Late that afternoon, Magno walked Matunho back to the port. The historian had enjoyed the visit, but didn't think much would come of it. Matunho seemed like just another curious passerby. Neither knew that Martino would become a central player in the town's struggle to survive. As it happens, fate placed Martino in charge of the court deciding the city's case. In December 2021, Martino called a meeting that drew officials from throughout Pará State. For the first time, the people of Fordlandia would have an opportunity to urge authorities publicly to preserve the city, and Magno had been selected as their representative. Magno felt as if he'd prepared for decades for this day. The son of the chauffeur of the American doctor, he'd been raised to respect what Ford built here. Studying the town's history for his college thesis, his admiration for Ford had only deepened. In a time when slave labor dominated much of the Amazon, the company had paid workers well and treated them with relative dignity. Then it had left it all behind, the makings and technology of a mighty Amazon city. Standing in front of the audience, Magno made his case for its historical designation. Within days, Martino delivered his decision. "The historic value of Fordlandia is incontestable," he wrote. "There remains to us no other measure but granting a historical designation." He ordered Brazil's Heritage Agency to finish the necessary paperwork and, by October 2022, to present to the community a complete restoration plan. But none of the deadlines were met. The designation was never awarded, and may never be. In a January filing, the agency doubted whether Fordlandia merited it. The community was found to have only potential archaeological value, the filing said. Potential value wasn't enough for a historical designation. The request was filed away for additional review. No further action had been taken. Magno no longer gives tours to random visitors. Other than attending to questions about history from lawyers and academics, he tries to live in the present rather than the past crumbling around him. But every now and then he sees a sign of neglect so egregious he has to look away. So the day he saw the guano dirtying the American-style house, he didn't go inside. Instead, he walked across the street to where a newcomer had moved in and witnessed what he'd come to believe was the birth of a new Fordlandia. Every year, more outsiders were coming to the town. Many were drawn by the promise of wealth that had nothing to do with its past. Shortly after Ford pulled out a massive deposit, 350 million tons of high-grade gypsum used in fertilizers and construction was discovered nearby. For decades, the difficulties of reaching Fordlandia had kept miners away. But now two companies were busy at work. Some days, Magno would stop and marvel at the size of their barge, weighed with thousands of tons of ivory-colored earth. "A new economic cycle is opening," said Martinho, the judge. And here now, before Magno, was more evidence of it. The newcomer, a transplant from the southeastern state of Minas Gerais, had not restored the American-style home, which had been badly vandalized and shorn of its roofing. Instead, he demolished it entirely and rebuilt it Brazilian style. "This is Brazil," said Jose Hakim, 68, admiring the house, painted teal blue. "And I'm Brazilian." Magno listened as Joaquin spoke of his plans for his house, a fence over here, a pool over there, and nodded in resignation. This was the other Fordlandia, the real Fordlandia. "And of course," Joaquin continued, "there will be a big barbecue grill." Magno smiled. He said the plan sounded nice. Then he finished the conversation and walked back to the school, where he had work to do. This story originally appeared in the Washington Post. Read one of the obituaries this week. The singer who took us to Margaritaville. Jimmy Buffett, 1946 to 2023. Jimmy Buffett was a struggling Nashville singer-songwriter with a failed marriage when he landed in Key West in 1971. Smitten by its sunbaked bohemian vibe and its cast of sailors, writers, drug runners, and hippies, Buffett found a lifestyle, he later said. He would build a hugely successful career on that lifestyle, with a catalog of breezy songs evoking a flip-flop clad existence, where the sand was white, work was a distant memory, and a fruity cocktail was always at hand. A perennial concert draw whose Hawaiian-shirted, grass-skirted fans were dubbed parrot heads, Buffett wrote enduring classics including Cheeseburger in Paradise, Why Don't We Get Drunk, and especially Margaritaville, the calypso-tinged tale of a dissolute beach bum searching for his lost shaker of salt. His music was pure escapism, Buffett said, scratching the universal itch to get away from whatever you do to make a living or other parts of life that stress you out. Buffett grew up in Mobile, Alabama, where his parents worked office jobs at a shipyard, said the Rolling Stone. A grandfather was a sea captain who filled Buffett's imagination with tales of his travels. At the University of Southern Mississippi, Buffett learned guitar with the hope of impressing girls and began playing local clubs and eventually bars on New Orleans Bourbon Street. He moved to Nashville and released a 1970 debut, Down to Earth, that sold under 400 copies. After a second dud, his third album, laced with low-key Key West vibe, inspired by his new home, picked up steam, said Billboard. He breached the top 40 with Come Monday in 1974. 3 years later came his breakthrough, Changes in Latitude, Changes in Attitude, propelled by Margaritaville. Despite his beach bum image, Buffett evolved into a savvy businessman, said the Washington Post. He spun the Margaritaville brand into restaurants, resorts, casinos, furniture, flip-flops, beer, a frozen drink machines, acquiring an estimated $1 billion fortune and boats, planes, and properties across the country. Buffett wrote best-selling books, launched a Broadway show, and remained a top summer concert draw until he contracted a rare skin cancer. "You know death will get you in the end," he wrote in a 1998 memoir, A Pirate Looks at 50. "But if you are smart and have a sense of humor, you can thumb your nose at it for a while." And we'll flip over to the Talking Points page. Start with Wisconsin, an ongoing assault on democracy. "Republicans no longer believe Wisconsin should be a functioning democracy," said Michael Tomasky in The New Republic. The state's GOP has relied on extreme partisan gerrymandering to control state House supermajorities, despite Democratic Assembly candidates winning about 200,000 more votes. Last year, that gerrymandering scheme and the right to an abortion were central issues in an election for the state Supreme Court, which progressive Janet Protasiewicz won by a landslide 11 points amid record turnout, giving liberal judges a 4-3 majority. Now the radical Republican legislature is moving to impeach Protasiewicz if she doesn't recuse herself of gerrymandering cases on the grounds she publicly criticized the GOP's rigged scheme and took $10 million in donations from the Democratic Party. Given that her conservative opponent took money from the GOP, the premise for impeaching her is laughable. Let's stop pretending that the GOP is a normal American political party. It's an authoritarian army of thugs in suits, hell-bent on minority rule. Protasiewicz is a good example of why judges shouldn't be elected, said Jim Jones, a former Idaho State Supreme Court judge in The Hill. While campaigning, she called Wisconsin's congressional map rigged and unfair, expressed staunch support for abortion rights, and accepted record contributions from the Democratic Party. All this gives voters the impression that judges are nothing more than politicians in black robes. Wisconsin Republicans, however, didn't object to that system until they lost a pivotal election, said Dan Kaufman in The New Yorker. They had zero complaints when conservative justices took millions from the GOP, or when conservative state Supreme Court Justice Brian Hagedorn described Planned Parenthood as a wicked organization more committed to killing babies than to helping women. Republicans have such breathtaking contempt for the people of Wisconsin that they're not ashamed of their hypocrisy, said Jamel Bowie in The New York Times. Since 2018, Wisconsin has voted for a more liberal legislature, governor, and state Supreme Court by significant margins, but Republicans have used extreme gerrymandering to maintain an unbreakable hold on power. In effect, Wisconsin voters can't elect a Democratic legislature or even choose their own state Supreme Court. If a majority of the people cannot, under any realistic circumstances, elect a legislative majority of their choosing, then it's hard to say whether they actually govern themselves. Musk, empowering anti-Semites? Elon Musk has an explanation for the mess he's made of Twitter, said Michael Hiltzik in the Los Angeles Times. It's all the Jews' fault. In a ferocious, spittle-flecked attack, Musk claimed last week that ad revenues at X, as Twitter is now called, had sunk 60% because of pressure on advertisers from the Anti-Defamation League. In several posts, he accused the Jewish rights group of trying to kill this platform by falsely accusing it and me of being anti-Semitic, and threatened to sue the ADL for defamation, saying he's owed at least $4 billion in damages. Musk also engaged with a post from a white supremacist that promoted the hashtag #BanTheADL and asked if he should run a poll on this. What has the ADL done to so infuriate the tech mogul? In May, it published a report showing how vile anti-Semitic content boomed after Musk bought the platform, reinstated previously banned accounts, and fired content moderators. As his outburst of anti-Semitism makes clear, Musk has gone utterly off the rails. Musk's criticism of ADL isn't anti-Semitic, said David Harsanyi in the New York Post. Run by a former Barack Obama appointee, the group has become a leftist social justice outlet that ignores progressive anti-Semitism while exaggerating the threat of anti-Semitism on the right. It dishonestly frames Musk's devotion to free speech as endorsement of anti-Semitic content. Yes, there are Jew haters on X, but that's an unfortunate price of open discourse. There are valid reasons to criticize the ADL, said Philip Klein in National Review. But by singling out the ADL among the many groups that have criticized hate speech on X, Musk validates the toxic views of those who see Jews as uniquely responsible for the world's ills. The irony is rich, said Margaret Sullivan in The Guardian, a self-proclaimed free speech absolutist. It is targeting the ADL for engaging in free speech. If anyone is culpable for wrecking X, it's Musk, who has hemorrhaged users and advertisers with a series of stunningly bad decisions. The thin-skinned billionaire has gone beyond blaming the ADL for X's business woes, said Yair Rosenberg in The Atlantic. He said they were one of the biggest generators of anti-Semitism on X because of their aggressive demands, feeding the age-old conceit that Jews bring about their own persecution. But no matter how many Jewish scapegoats he slaughters, Musk won't be able to fix his platform's woes. They stem from his own inadequacy, not Jewish mendacity. And we've just time for a quote to finish the show. This comes from George Burns. He says, "By the time you're 80 years old, you've learned everything. You only have to remember it." And with that, we have run out of time for today's episode of the week. We hope you've enjoyed it. Be sure to listen again next time. This is Fred Woodward for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The week is available as a podcast on our website, ncreadingservice.org. For more information or if you have comments or questions, please give us a call, 919-832-5138. It's 919-832-5138. And thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.